I was thinking about step one, two, and three. For me, it came like I was 3 days sober, and it just came to me. And I was wondering how do I sponsor my sponsees if they haven't felt it here.
This one was for Carrie, I think. No.
I'm not sure if I really understood the question. I think I did. We'll just see. We'll see by my answer if I understood the question, right? I can't tell you what you're going to feel. My job is to lay it out. My job is to explain the hopelessness of this situation in the beginning. Stress the malady. Paint them into a corner. Let them reach the conclusion that they are, in fact, an alcoholic. And when they ask me, how in the heck do you stay sober? Now I got them. Now I get to stress what it is. And I spend time going through that doctor's opinion and going through, you know, pages 21 and 22, especially page 24, page 30, to paint this picture and then hit them with a solution. And I spend two of my favorite pages, one of my Hotmail accounts is J.A. Kelly, P63. I love that page. Because when they get to that page, when they see the ugly truth about selfishness and self-centeredness, and then you flip the page or you go over to page 63 and you show them what's on this information and I tell them how I did my third step, they then have the opportunity to get what I got or better. Did I answer your question? Okay.
Let me add one thing to that, if I may. That I don't differ with what John's saying, but there's one thing that I like to do with a person is recognize that the first thing I want to do is help them regain the spirit, to gain the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous, not the fact of it. But I want them to gain the spirit so that they've got the willingness to engage in the process. If I don't do that, and I try to get them too quickly into doing the work of Alcoholics Anonymous, I can miss that spirit, you know, and so I wind up working on the head instead of the heart. And so the number one thing that is kind of like it says in the book, and that Carrie talked about it last night, that our experience has conditioned us to be of maximum effectiveness, and what we're really given is hope. And so when somebody comes in, I always see a dead person walking. And so the first thing I want to do is give him a hand. And then the next thing I want to do is put something in his hand, preferably something he can work with. So I want him to sort of get his spirit back, to get a little sense of being in the right place with the right people. Then we go to work. First thing I want to do is get him into the first 43 pages. I want him to live there and nowhere else, and let him get his head right a little bit there, and then we'll take off. But that's what I like doing.
I just want to quickly point out that the Big Book is set up perfectly. It is a 12-step in print. And if you start on page 1 and you end on page 165, there's nothing more that you need to say. I sit and I read it with my sponsees. And by the time I get to step 3, just like John said, they're beaten by the truth of their malady. And so the Big Book does it perfectly. So all I have to do is sit and read and share it with them.
Similar question, but when I heard the word outside second generation comes to you and wants who's a person who is willing to, or you know, you ask to be a sponsor, of course you say yes, and that person, he or she is trying to work the thing 10, 11 and 12, do you start all over again with a new person, or
is it for Carrie?
I always start all over. The old saying that to drink is to die. I first thought that meant you fell over, But what it means is that you die spiritually. And so I always start over. I don't resume sponsorship. I reestablish sponsorship. So I want to get I think the worst mistake that a new person can make is to come in under the notion of starting over or resuming, picking up where you left off. There is no picking up where you left off. Mm-hmm. I just elaborate this much, that for many, many years, I wondered why it was so difficult for people to come back who had gotten a recovery going and then lost it. And, Jesus, it just looked like it was almost impossible to recapture that thing. And I was troubled by that, because I went to an awful lot of funerals of people who just could not make it back. And I read a thing by William James, the fellow that Bill Wilson quoted a lot. I read a thing by William James that said, very simply, no state of mind once attained and lost can ever be regained and be the same. Mm-hmm. There's no second first honeymoon. There'll only be one first honeymoon. Yeah. And there's no renewal of a recovery that has terminated. You can't get it back. And you watch people beat their brains out trying to recapture what they had. They never will. They'll either have to settle for less or go for more. But there is no starting back the same place.
Yeah, I'm going to ask some of the questions that we have here on a note. I have a question specifically for Carrie. So how do you recommend making amends to children, 7-year-old children? And what if you hurt your child again after making those amends?
Well, I think it depends. See, the one thing about the 9-step, and in the big book, it says that it says that we need to check with other people before we go to make an amends. We'll make that really clear. So anything that I'm offering today is based on my experience, but I haven't heard your 5th step, so I don't know your circumstance. So it's not my fault. With that said, I think that, my daughter has never seen me drink, but I've had to make amends to her because I'm not a perfect mom. In fact, I'm far from perfect. And I think that one of the things that we have to realize is that our children know when we're messed up. Even if they never saw us take a drink, even if they never actually saw what we have, the consequences of our drinking, I think that our children deserve the amends. So, but we also have to be very careful about how we do it, because there's this whole thing about harming others. So it's been my experience, and what I've directed the women that I sponsored to do when they made amends to their children, and what I have done is I've sat down and I've discussed with, or they've discussed with their children in a general way, what their harms were. And the thing is, the wonderful thing about the 10th step and the 11th step is that I get to make amends every gosh darn day. So the thing is when I sit down with my daughter, when my sponsees have sat down with their children and they made direct amends to their children, they made a first approach. They didn't fulfill the amends. I do not fulfill my amends until I am in that pine box. That's my experience. Until I paid back every cent of that money, until I stop causing harm in people's life, and I'll probably be dead when I do that, I'm not done. I don't believe that amends are completed. I think that, so I believe this, is I believe that I have a direct conversation with the child, and the child is 7, so their ability to understand, so I have to take that into consideration. I need to discuss it with a sponsor. I need to talk to other mothers. I might also consult somebody from Al-Anon. See, I have Al-Anon cronies that I have in my life that I use to bounce this stuff off of too, because alcoholics are dense. And and as much as we might work the steps wonderfully, sometimes a non-alcoholic who works the spiritual program and works the 12 steps can give some wonderful advice. And so, you know, I bring these things into consideration. But yeah, I do think that making a direct amends to a child is good, but I think you have to be careful. And the bottom line is this, is that once I have that conversation and I make that first approach, you know, if I fall short on that, I need to own it. You know, I don't know how many times I've apologized to my daughter for losing my temper, for not doing it right. And you know what I'm teaching? I'm teaching my daughter to recognize when she falls short and says, and I taught her to say sorry by showing her how to say sorry. So I am as accountable to my children as I am to my sponsor. More so, because my sponsor doesn't live with me. And trust me, my children will say, Mommy, you're grumpy today. You know, so I do. So and there have been times when I've gone through really stressful times in my life, when maybe I was a little too involved with my sponsees, because I do some radical 12-step work, some of the stuff that that John was talking about, and my children have sometimes taken the back burner because I'm an alcoholic. My priorities can get screwed up, and I've had to go make amends for that. So yeah, I do think that you need to, that if you fall short, you need to continue to make amends. And I think children are people too. Does that answer it?
Good. Anybody else want to add to it? Come on. Hello, my name is Peter. I'm a newcomer. I have a big heart. How can I know I'm not practicing my sick desire for recognition when I'm helping? Am I doing God's work, or is it because of my codependency?
I don't think it makes a heck of a lot of difference, you know, when you get right down to it. The fact of the business is that, it's kind of like she was asking about this morning, my belief is there's no such thing as an unselfish act. And that when I do something, I'm the winner. And I don't really care what it is. You know, that, you know, what motivates me, what drives me, is that I want to live in a friendly world. I want to live with friendly people. You know, I want to live in a world where there's a what I just said. That, and so to do that, I'm the initiator. And so what I find is what I put out, I normally get back. Normally. Not always. But I got enough sense to recognize when I'm dealing with an idiot. Yeah. And I know how to get away, you know. So I don't, in that kind of thing, I don't spend a lot of time in analysis paralysis. You know, I decide on how I want to live. I practice that as a way of life. And, man, it pays off big time. So it really doesn't make that much difference to me. The brainy ones might have a different slant on that.
No, I concur with what he says. I don't analyze it. I mean, my God, I will screw up everything. You know, I just do what I do. I got a sponsor who holds me accountable, and I just do what I do. I don't think about, oh, is this my ego, or, you know, my ego will get out of whack just like everybody else's. But I also have some people that are in my group that I run around with, that if my little head starts to grow, they'll smack me back down. And if my head starts to grow and I'm out there doing what I do, I'm not going to be effective. You know, so I just rely on God to take me where He needs to take me, and I just do what I do. And I try not to get into what I think. I just try to do what this says. And then I don't have to worry about what my motives are or whatever about this. My God. I'm supposed to be relying on God, not self-analysis. I can't do that. I mean, I get tired head, and I just, you know, just like, oh, my God. I just take the action and let God take me where he needs to be. And if I need to be corrected, oh, I'll get corrected. You know? I step off into it, and I don't follow the guidelines laid down on here. My sponsor asked me about it. He asked me a few probing questions. He says, did you follow the... And I'm like, no. And he's like, well, big boy, you bought the ticket. Now you ride the ride. The 10-step gives me precise instructions on how to correct these things. I rely on God. I discuss it with someone. And then I repair any damage that I've done. And then I turn my thoughts to who I can help. It's a very simple deal. It's a very simple deal. And that's a design for living that works. And see, my problem wasn't stopping drinking. I didn't have a way to live sober. And this program gives me a way to live sober and an answer to all my problems. That's all I got.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to throw something in because I kind of differ from these guys because I'm extremely egotistical. And there's not a lot of women who do the kind of work that I do. So I often get put in a position of an authority in the area that I live in. I mean, there's my sponsor, a couple of my friends. We sponsor tons of women. So I go to a meeting, and there's 20, 30 women that I've brought through the work at that meeting. And you know what I do? I pick up cigarette butts in the coffee and the coffee cups in the parking lot. I take coffee commitments. I don't always chair meetings. I don't always, if I speak and I know that I've spoken, I've been invited to speak at anniversaries, if I've been invited to speak often, like after this, I'm sitting quiet. I'm taking a greeting commitment. I make sure that I'm not just up front, but I'm behind the scenes. Because it's not humility in sitting up here. It's humility picking up those coffee cups. It's humility shaking hands. That's where the 12-step work actually happens. It happens at my kitchen table where no one else is around and no one else sees. And so that's been my experience, and I don't allow people to put me on a pedestal. And that's something that I make very clear because you carry good message and people want to believe that you walk on water. And I make it really clear to the women that I work with that you're going to kill me and you're going to kill yourself if you do that. You know, and it's about, for me, it's about humility. But yeah, my ego has gotten involved. But because I want to save people. And the truth is that it's not about saving you. It's about saving my ass. And when it's between me and a bottle and whether or not I'm going to pick up a bottle today, because a friend of mine put a big book and a bottle at a table. And he said, which one are you going to choose? And the bottom line, it comes back to that. But yeah, sometimes 12-step work has served my ego and it has got me in some deep trouble. So for me, I have to be aware of it. And I ask myself, am I taking this commitment because I want to look good? Am I going to this rehab because I want to feel superior? Or I'm here because I want to help? And I let the newcomers speak. I let my sponsee speak. People ask me to speak, and I give them 5-10 phone numbers of the women that I sponsor. So now I'm not always the one who's out there up front. But the newer generation can get the 12-step experience. Women ask me to sponsor them, and I say, well, I can help you, but you know what? My sponsees are better than me. And I let them get their hands dirty. You know, that's just for me. Thanks.
Okay, here's one for Tom. Where does the line between AA and family life lie? When are you neglecting your family?
I'm glad my wife didn't hear that question. that's a critically important question, and one I think we all have to resolve. I think John hit it very well this morning when he was talking about this pursuit of balance. A lot of time we get so busy trying to design our lives that we forget to live it. Anybody who gets actively involved in this program, particularly if you get into a service dimension, you're going to be confronted with a crisis in this area of figuring out when do you start to do things at the expense of people. The guideline, and I'll tell you this, I'm a good guy to ask about that, because I have been as busy in Alcoholics Anonymous as long as anybody I know, and as much as anybody I know. So I'm a good guy to ask. What I found is that everything I do has principles that establish it. My marriage has principles. They're principles that I've vowed to observe in my marriage. My program has principles that are absolute in terms of how I live my life. My work has principles in it. So what I have to do is live according to principles. Now, so that's the general way that I try to stay, so that I'm being of real service and I'm being of real value in the relationship that I've made commitments. If I'm doing something at the expense of something else, then I'm off base with the thing. Like, I travel almost every week of my life. And working Fridays for me is almost a joke. It's always been a joke in my organizations. Now, I've had an understanding with all of the organizations that I have been involved with that we don't meet on Fridays. And most folks, well, everybody... So far, well, I finished my career, so everybody all through my career were amenable to accommodating my schedule. Now, that was great, because if they hadn't been, it would have created a real quandary. So what I did is make up for my absence with other work during the week, and I was situated such a way that I could do that. So it requires some accommodation like that. In the family... The agreement that I make with my family, and they understand that this is something that I'm committed to, what I do in Alcoholics Anonymous. They understand that. And so what we do is plan ahead. Like when my kids are going to college, I always ask them about 2 years before graduation, when do you graduate? And they always say, how do we know? I said, well, go find out. Somebody knows. You know, somebody has the information. They know exactly what day your class will graduate. Find that out. Then that goes on my calendar, and that is a commitment. That's a commitment. So I have to plan ahead. So that's a reasonable accommodation that my family makes. I'll give you an example of this, and I dwell on this a little bit because it is an awfully important question. Fundamental to it is to differentiate, to make a difference between activity and commitments. There's a big difference, a very important difference. I said I was active. Most of those activities are optional. Coming to Iceland was optional. Once I put it on the calendar, it was not optional. But it was optional up to that point. This is an action, it's an activity, but I don't live or die with this. My home group is not an option. It's not negotiable. On Monday and Thursday night, I will be at my group unless there's something of overriding importance in my judgment. Like sometimes I'll go speak at another group or something, you know, where I think there's a real purpose to be served. But that's a commitment. A big difference between committed action and activity. And I won't dwell on it anymore, but to me that's an awfully key distinction that starts to sort this out. I'll tell you how that works in real life. My son is... I told somebody to break. I thought he was working on becoming a good AA member, because we went away to school. He majored in fraternity and was really looked good for membership. And then he went bad and went into medicine. And so now he's a physician and a busy guy, and he's got enough money to take us to dinner. So he came to visit one time. And he said, I would like to take you guys someplace nice for dinner. I said, that'd be great for a change. And he said, and he caught himself. He caught himself. He said, oh, this is meeting night. You hear what I'm saying? This is meeting night. I didn't say I've got to go to AA and that's more important than you. He understood the commitment. That's part of knowing me, of knowing what I stand for. You can trust somebody who keeps commitments. You can't trust somebody who's unpredictable. And so that's an awfully key distinction in sorting out about this sort of hazy balance, eh? Between one piece of my life and another. It's a matter of being accountable, of being responsible, so that folks can trust you and know who you are. And once they do, they can either accept you or not. But if you're somebody who's hard to pin down, you're going to be hard to trust. And so I think that's what it comes to. There's some of it is fairly hard line. But I'm not playing a parlor game. My stakes here are my life. And so everybody who knows me knows this thing. And so I think they call that integrity of being what you say you are. Very important question.
Yeah, hello. I was thinking, you know, last week I found myself in the situation. I was kind of arguing a mental obsession with a sponsor because he was having doubts that he was alcoholic and he was thinking about going out to take a drink. And the big book suggests that if you're still not convinced, you should go out, try to drink, and stop. And I found there is no circumstance I can find, you know, that I could accept this from a sponsor or suggest it to them, that they do this test. Has any one of you suggested this test and under what circumstances?
Let's put John work
in. I don't suggest that. It's a truism that this is what we could do. Let's say that it was you, and I'm working with you. I have no way of knowing if that is your last drink. And I'm not going to lead you to your last drink. I lay out the information and I talk to these people and I am not going to get in between you and God and your last drink. I'm here to share my experience. And if a guy doesn't want to do what I do, then he needs to do what he needs to do. And I'm not going to interfere. You know, I mean, I could be a hard ass and say, well, hey, come on, let's go to the liquor store. And that's always been an option. But I found that if they're not sold in their heart, if they have a lurking notion, there's nothing that I can say to keep them from drinking. So they're going to have to do what they have to do. Nobody could keep me from drinking. No thing could keep me from drinking. Until I ran out of options, until I had no more lurking notions, I was never willing to go to the links that I go to. And I pray for them, and I ask God to do what they need to do. And I let them go. And I think that's my final answer.
I've actually been asked that question a couple times, because as I go through the book with my sponsees, we go through all the different tests. There's several tests and more about alcoholism. And one of the things that I focus on a lot with that, and because, I'll get the newcomer and I'll be like, well, so, I can drink. It says, go drink. And the two things is, one, it says the test I heard, and I got this from a couple guys in Texas, is take two drinks a day for 30 days. So I said to them, I said, well, do you think in your heart of hearts you could take two drinks a day for 30 days? I'm like, no, man, I couldn't drink two drinks a day for 30 days. I said, well, doesn't that mean you're an alcoholic? So I think that's a trick question, because any real alcoholic who's faced with the idea of only taking two drinks a day for 30 days knows that they can't take two drinks a day for 30 days. We all know in our hearts that two drinks a day for 30 days is not going to happen. Might happen for one day. It might happen for an hour. But there's no way on God's green earth that an alcoholic can take two drinks a day for 30 days and take no more than that. So that's what I do. When I get to that question and somebody asks, well, what is that all about? I say, well, there's this test, two drinks a day for 30 days. And they say, well, I can't do that. And I said, that's because you're an alcoholic. You know, so I think that that's sort of like one of those trick questions. But there's other tests in there. And as the book goes on, you read two more pages down, and it says, well, you know, all these tests are pretty arbitrary. Instead, let's take a look at the way that we think preceding a relapse. Instead of trying to test how we drink, why don't we test how we think and decide whether we're an alcoholic? So the question doesn't end with those tests. It actually, those are just one aspect of it. So if you keep going the next couple pages and you go through Jim and, oh, what the heck's that other guy's name? Fred. Yeah, Fred, the guy, the no cloud on the horizon guy. If you go through those stories, you know, they're just as powerful as those tests, if not more.
Ég spyr bara spurninga til skiptis frá blöðum, þannig að þið vilja þá bara réttu upp hönda á milli. Yeah, so a question for Tom. Do you set some ground rules to people you sponsor? For example, A, how many meetings a week, and B, how long time you will get to go to the 12th step? How long time you will get to reach the 12th step, yeah.
Let me tell you my approach to sponsorship, what I've arrived at. I believe that sponsorship is a tremendously important personal relationship. I also believe it's a shared relationship. And so I won't go into sponsorship without a substantial period of time in planning and negotiating how we will operate. And so I don't dictate how we'll operate. People are not the same, and I don't have one set pattern by which people are going to behave. And so what I do is meet with people, and then we will work out whatever kind of arrangement is going to be workable in our agreed judgment. And so we'll do that. Now, I've got some minimum standards that I do have some fixes on. One is a home group. You know, it doesn't have to be mine. I don't care where he goes to meetings. But a home group is something that I think is tremendously important. I'm not going to be dealing with somebody floating in space. And so also the agreement that I'm the only game in town. You know, if I'm going to be the sponsor, I'm the only one you got. I'm not somebody who believes in service sponsors and spiritual advisors and all that stuff. You know, I'm a one-stop shopping guy. And so if I'm the sponsor, I'm the sponsor. And when a new guy shows up, we're back to the negotiating board because I won't do that. So those are kind of fixed things. A service activity, preferably one that takes you outside the group. Now, there's not much better work than washing coffee pots. But that's a kind of a narrow realm of service. And so I want to have a service commitment that puts you into the world somewhat, like that going to that broken down wind up place. That's a service commitment. So things like that. Very important to me is not so much what I want to dictate, but that we have a real clear agreement about what we're going to do. When I see sponsorship break down, it's almost always traceable back to the lack of proper planning, proper establishment of the relationship so that it's understood. And so when I do that, I feel pretty good. If somebody stops me in a hall, and you run into it all the time, somebody stops me in a hall. I had a guy just a while back that moved in from California, and I've, to my state, which is all the way across the country. And you'd have to understand the United States to understand this. But when you move from California to rural North Carolina, you got culture shock, big time. I mean, lack of culture shock. And so I go to this meeting, and I speak to a group, and this guy comes up and says, "Thanks, will you sponsor me?" And I said, "No." He was kind of shocked, you know. He said, "Well, my God, yeah. Will you at least talk to me?" I said, "Yeah, I'll do that." Yeah, but, you know, my pat answer would be no. I mean, that's like hitting on somebody in a bar, you know. That's not sponsorship. You know, that's tag stuff, you know. And all the guy was responding to was he was looking for signs of life. And he saw me and recognized it as signs of life. And but if I had agreed to that, it would have been stupid. Yeah. And so what we've agreed on now is that we're going to meet... We just made the agreement last week. Once a week, we're going to meet. Now, the only way I could do that, I'm not sponsoring him, but we're going to meet once a week. The only way I could do that is that I sponsor a prison, and so I'm going to meet him at the prison. So we'll take care of his needs while he's taking care of somebody else's needs. So we'll do it both ways. So anyway, that's kind of a long, long way of visiting that. Key thing I said was, I do not have a set method. I absolutely insist on real negotiation. Three qualities I want in place. I want to know that I'm the guy, I'm the sponsor, and that I've got unlimited access to that person's life. I don't sponsor somebody's not drinking. I believe that alcoholism is an illness that's totally consuming. So I want access to the life. I want an open invitation to walk into that person's life without any apology or any advance notice. I'm the guy that can walk up and start talking, then they'll listen. They can argue later if they want to. But I want them to understand I'm going to talk first. And then we'll talk a little more if we need to. I think it's an awfully, awfully important thing that sponsorship is my most tangible link to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I don't want that to be a lightweight kind of a little social arrangement. I want that to be an important investment that I'm going to let somebody into my life or somebody's going to let me into their life. So I want to do that on good, solid ground. Yeah. You guys...
Hunter... Okay,
this is to John. How to hold sponsors accountable?
I could give a smart ass answer and say booze will hold them accountable, but no, I won't do that. No, we have guidelines. I don't have like a really set in stone idea, but I do almost what he does. We're going to form a partnership, and this is what we're going to do. And there's no gray area. You know, it's kind of like a leadership type deal. You know, if I take on a guy and I'm not clear, and then this messes up, that's not his fault. That's my fault. But I do set some guidelines, some parameters, and. Should they neglect those or fall short of those, it's my job, not in a group setting, but one-on-one, to sit that person down and say, you know, we had an agreement here. And it was decided in the beginning that you were willing to go to any length to recover from this illness. And it's my job to guide you through this work. And I see in this area that you're falling short of our agreed-upon goal. Why is that? And we've got some countermeasures in place, and they're either going to do it or they're not going to do it. And I found that if it's kind of like that integrity thing, If I go to them and speak to them in a clear and understanding and a loving way and show them this work and show them from my experience how this work and what I'm asking them has benefited me, they're more than likely going to do that. And should they have their own ideas, my hat's off to them. You know, it's kind of like, let me know how that works out for you. You know? Accountability can be rough sometimes. I guess probably the most things that, I don't know, probably attending service commitments, that's probably one area that is greatly, I hold their feet to the fire on this. I think another thing is the 13th step. And I'm just totally of the opinion that just because there's a good-looking girl in AA, that she's fair game, especially a newcomer. And I do hold them accountable. And I do say that, you know, that kind of nonsense, this is a safe place, and that kind of nonsense is not going to go on in our group. And that kind of puts me on the wrong side of a lot of folks, but I see that from my experience, that is what is needed. And I just don't have too many big problems like that. I mean, it seems to all work out. My sponsor holds me accountable as well. And there's been some times where he's given me some suggestions on what to do and how things are going to work out, and I just do not get it. And I swear I'm going to find another sponsor, you know. But I follow his advice and I follow his directions, and every time a day or two or three goes by and I'm sitting in front of my sponsor saying, you know what, you're right. I did what you suggested, and what I thought was the reality was not the reality, and your experience has guided me to where I needed to go, and that works out. And now I get to pass that on to my guys. I don't fire anybody. They fire themselves. That's all I got.
Anybody else? I got a lot of questions anyways. Go. So, Carrie, casual sex, ? If both people agree, ? Help.
Good one. You guys always give me the good ones. Casual sex. Well, all right, I'm going to give you my honest opinion. I don't believe that sex can be casual. The Big Book says that sex should not be taken lightly. It says that we shouldn't, get too crazy about it, but it also says that we shouldn't take it lightly. I believe that in this day and age, there are massive consequences for sex. And I think that women, we tend to have sex with men. I'm speaking for myself. I used to have sex with men because I believed if I had sex with you, you were going to stay with me. I was going to keep you. See, for me, sex was a way of making you want to be with me. But what I didn't realize is that I was having sex with a guy, and he was thinking, she's a slut. I'm not taking her home. I just nailed her in 2 hours. I'm not kidding. So the point is that I think that a lot of times sex tends to be manipulation. I think that it tends to be something that alcoholics use arbitrarily. I think that women, I can use it to get affection, attention. I don't always use it for good motives. And the bottom line, if it doesn't apply to the four absolutes, I shouldn't do it. And it's very rare that a casual sex situation applies to the four absolutes. In fact, I've never heard of it. And beyond that, I give a suggestion to the women that I sponsor. It's something called the 10-date rule. I make it up. I have a couple rules. No. And it's the 10-date suggestion. And what that suggests is that you not have sexual contact with a member of the pool of people that you're attracted to. I sponsor lots of different types of people, so I have to put it that way. You not have sex with or sexual contact with those people.
Tell them what the four absolutes are.
Oh, I did, but I'll tell them again. you not have sex with them or any kind of sexual contact, no making out, no oral sex, none of that stuff, for 10 dates. Because the thing is that most women use sex to get love and affection, and most of the time we end up getting hurt. And I find that it's very rare that I can have sex with another person without gaining feelings for them. I think that casual sex is a delusion, because I don't really believe that it exists. And if it does exist, most of the people that I found that believe that it exists actually had some deep, severe psychiatric problems. Seriously. They had some other addictions. And so, I'm not kidding. I mean, the fact is that, you know, people think that they're having sex arbitrarily, and it turns out that they're being driven by all different kinds of things that they're not aware of. You know, they've been sexually abused, physically abused, and they're taking those issues out in their sexual relationships. And just to clarify, the four absolutes, for once again, for Peter, is absolute honesty, absolute purity, so purity, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love. And for the guys who think that they're having casual sex with a girl and that she's agreeing to it, she's probably lying to you. Because she thinks if she has sex with you, that you will want to make her your girlfriend. Am I lying, guys? Women? Am I lying? See? I'm not making this up. So I think that a lot of times casual sex is something that we put over something that's usually... I heard someone say, and this guy Hector, he said that alcoholics are skin hungry. And what it means is that we want to touch another human being and feel connection and feel love. And often we'll go to sex to do that because we can't do it any way else. Because to risk emotions, to risk a vulnerability, to risk that honesty without taking your clothes off is the scariest mother effing thing you're ever going to do in your life. And a lot of times I'll go to sex to avoid having to do that. You know, Marianne Williamson, and I'm quoting her, and I know this is AA, says that she said that you can be more naked with your clothes off. And for me, you know, I can have sex with you, I can be naked, I can run through the streets naked, I have. And I've never been more shut down and closed off from other human beings. And I've never been more vulnerable in my life and with my clothes on and sharing my soul with another human being. And that's what I'm about. Forget orgasms. I can have that on my own. I want to share my soul with another human being. That's what this deal is about for me. Did that answer it?
Yeah. As a resident sex expert, let me add. I tell you, I would not oversimplify this because I don't know of a more difficult thing than for self-centered alcoholics to work out wholesome relationships with other people, no matter who they are. That's a challenge. But if you look at the sex portion of the inventory, it's the finest statement of principles guiding sexual activity of anything I've ever seen. And it says it in a couple of paragraphs, which I think is just excellent.
Yeah, that's exactly where I was going to go with this. What does the big book say? You know, I really believe that God does not want me to treat the girls in my life like Kleenex anymore. No matter what the quote-unquote motives for each of us may be. And page 62 tells me that I must be rid of this selfishness. I must, or it will kill me. And regardless of what my delusion is about this relationship, if it's selfish and I continue to harm others and I continue to harm myself, I'm liable to drink again. You know, my sobriety is my responsibility. And so if I screw up, does that mean I'm going to drink? No. If I'm sorry for what I've done and I ask God to take me to better things, am I going to be all right? Yeah. But I can't get by in life. I can't just be sober and then continue to treat you like Kleenex and treat me like Kleenex. Because it's not only harming you, it's harming me. It's harming my spirit. And I just don't want to live that way anymore. And as much as I've tried to have casual sex, no strings attached, dang it. There's always a string attached. always. That's just my story. I mean, I know folks that can do it or get by with it, they seem to. That's just not me. I can't live that way.
Okay, here's a question to no one in particular. In regards to people taking a passive approach to God, saying, God will tell me what to do, what to say, do you think God intervenes? For instance, does God bring people to AA at his, her discretion?
I think I kind of got at this a little bit this morning in my approach to it. I belong to the Methodist Church, but I think spiritually I'm a Buddhist is what I really am. I'm not somebody who tries to look for specific signals and messages and things like that. What I've found is that with the power living within me, I instinctively know what to do. You know, like the book says, it will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. I find that to be true. And what I find is that when I have a hunch, if you think about this, when I have a hunch about something I ought to do and don't, I always regret it. I always regret it. And to me, that's what the signal is. It's not a matter of being directed like... Like I mentioned, when I'm going to speak to the group, I always ask God not to tell me what to say, not to write me a script. I ask God to help me to be straight, to be honest, to be clear, to recognize the seriousness of what I'm doing, and so that I don't get way off somewhere. And so what God gives me is the power. You know, I'm not a spiritual robot. He gave me a brain, an incredible brain. I wear a size 7 5/8 hat. Jesus, I got a brain bigger than a moose. But I mean, he didn't give me that just for decoration, you know. And I don't think God's going to be saying, turn left here, you know, turn right, baloney. You know, he gives me the spirit, the drive, the power to do the things in front of me. You know, and so I'm not somebody who gets into that traffic signal stuff.